Oops. Hello and welcome to our NEPT content and curriculum call. And this is for February 2017. And these are the calls where we can get on and just chat about some of the content and the modules and specific technical things you have questions about or things that you have questions about how to apply in your practice and in your work with people or anything at all. So usually what we do is we start out there with those kinds of questions. And then if we run out of those kinds of questions and then you do have some questions, say, that are more related to a client, a case or a marketing thing or something else related to your practice and anything at all goes. So we'll get started with who has questions that they want to ask about modules. I'd love to hear what module you're studying right now and what you want help with and go for it. The way you can do it is either you can show your screen and you can wave to me and I'll see you, and that's a wave that raise the hand. And then I always forget, Lynn, there's a way, I think if you go by the participants and you go by next to your name, there's a way to raise your hand. I know there's a way for me to lower hand, but there's no way for me to raise my hand, I don't think. So I think that's the way it goes. If I just go, I think under more. For me, it's more, and it says lower hand if the hand is up. So who has questions, comments, things we want to talk about? What's a good topic for us to chat about related to, you know, the geeky stuff, right? The back end biochemistry, anatomy, physiology, the stuff that, you know, it's all about, and have some conversations about that. I know we've seen some good discussions on Facebook, and I post some in the weekly, what do we call those? Clinical pearls. I try to give you, you know, just more stuff that you can use. Anything goes. Anybody? Questions? Comments? Share what module you're working on? What are you studying? Nobody? Nobody. We have a, for those in mastery and certification, the adrenal stuff has been updated and it's been in process for the last couple of months, just trying to get it together in terms of getting it, all that stuff posted. A couple of other things I could share. We're looking into revitalizing the membership site so that we have better access and, quicker access and some improvements on the back end. We've hired a team to come in and look at how we can optimize that. So I'm excited about that. We're working on incorporating all the stuff you saw in the digestive mastery and also, yeah, and into all the others. So you had a lot of places where you could go in and click off your objectives and then take a test. We're incorporating that into all. I think we've changed over the first two modules testing so that we're not using that thing called exam professor anymore, that it's housed right there within our site. We're excited about that. That's an upgrade we made a few months ago that has been just taking time to get in. Anything else? Questions, comments? Anything that
can question?
Yeah, go for it. Hi, Drina. Oh no, that's not Drina.
It's Val.
Okay, I saw Drina, but as soon as I heard your voice, Drina's screen came up. So I'm like, oh, it's Drina, but then, yeah.
I know that in blood sugar control, we're trying to spread out meals to stabilize blood sugar. Yep. And I'm reading some other things about HPA access and adrenal issues. And of course, you know, so many people recommend the many meals a day and all. So I'm trying to figure out, under what circumstances does it make sense to have more frequent meals, and how do you know?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there are very key ways to know. In fact, I saw as I was getting ready, I'm doing a thing with JJ Virgin this afternoon about her book, and I was going to her site, and I saw she posted this really nice little recent thing about meal timing, and I wanted to see what, you know, she had to say, and it was totally inconsistent, totally consistent with what we're saying. And she basically said, all those places that are telling you eat frequently, just throw them away. But there are situations. So a child, right? A growing child who cannot eat enough at a meal to sustain themselves between the meals, right? A very thin, frail person, right? Who doesn't have blood sugar issues, but if they just can't, they have either impaired digestion or they're just very small and they eat very small meals, then they need to eat more to sustain themselves, or they're going to lose a lot of weight. I never see a situation where an obese person needs to eat more frequently. I have not seen that. I just haven't seen it. And they tell them, oh yeah, you need it to keep up your metabolism. And really, if you look at the science, which I'm going to go into more detail when I do the presentation on timing, I think on Tuesday or Wednesday this week, is like, no, the science shows that your metabolism slows down when you eat more frequently because you're in an insulin overdrive. So how would you know? Like certain times when I've had people join our program and they start to space it out. So they go from eating every 2 hours to going, okay, I'm going to go 5 hours. And they get palpitations and agitation. They get sweaty in between. What is that? Well, that's their body going into an adrenal emergency situation where now they've got this adrenaline coursing through and go, we need sugar. What it indicates is that their glucose balancing is out. Their glucagon isn't kicking in when it's supposed to, right? And why? Well, maybe pancreatic overload, or there's a number of reasons for that. So I think that if person spreads it out and they get really, you know, agitated and they feel sweaty and palpitations and all that, then you need to move back. Doesn't mean you can't do that overall. You just need to be able to help them to balance those meals so that there's enough content in that meal to last them. And if you can certainly balance your fat, protein, and carb in a meal such that you don't have to eat for 4 or 5 hours, but it could take a few weeks to get them there. And in the meantime, they're running out of fuel. They're not good at kicking into being fat burners, because they're so used to eating so often, they become a glucose burner and they become really good at burning glucose, and their cells have adapted to just burning glucose and they can't burn the fat, right? Other people fall into it like beautifully. They go, wow, that was great. I didn't like eating often like that anyway. I only did it because they told me to. So anybody that has that feeling between, and it's always helpful if somebody is saying, oh, I have to eat every 2 hours because I get agitated and I get shaky and irritable, then you work with them to slowly spread that out, to go to 15 minutes longer, to go to 30 minutes, and allow the body to kick in with adaptation before you throw it into this stressful situation of, instead of 2 hours, now it's 5 hours, and they just muscle it out. That's not a good thing to do.
So it's really basically just a blood sugar thing and really not an HPA axis, adrenal fatigue thing.
No, I mean, it kicks into an emergency situation because the body doesn't know how to break down body tissue. It doesn't know how. Those are those same people that wake up at 2 in the morning, 4 in the morning, and they're hungry. They eat something, they go back to sleep. It's because their mechanisms are out of whack. They're totally out of whack. And then that's where we're changing their diet over. We're getting on the right supplements so that they have the right balance of nutrients. We're, you know, eating more easy to digest foods, pre-digested, soaked and sprouted and germinated foods, so that the pancreas doesn't have to kick in so much. Because remember, the pancreas is a dual function organ, right? It's an endocrine gland, but it's also got this function of digestive enzymes, right? So if you're stressing it out with the typical diet of highly processed, very heavily cooked, enzyme depleted food, that pancreas is working hard, and then you're also doing a lot of sugars, which the pancreas is working really hard at, then the pancreas kind of gets tired and it can't kick in. But if you slowly adapt, it's like a muscle, right? I'm weightlifting. I start with a little weight. I don't start with 30 pounds, but maybe over the course of 3-4 months, I'm able to lift 30 pounds no problem because I allowed my body to adapt to it. So I think it's the same thing. I don't think there's anything inherent in the HPA axis that makes it so people have to eat regularly. It's such that they need to maintain a steady stream of fuel. And whether that fuel is ketones or sugar, if the body gets adapted to it, it's not stressful. Now, people who are very severely adrenally depleted, a ketogenic diet is way too strong for them, so to speak. You know, right. You can't just jump them right into a ketogenic diet, but you could do the gradual, you know, movement towards that. And I'm not a big fan of a true ketogenic diet for long periods of time. It's a good therapeutic thing, but a borderline ketogenic, like where your body's really good at switching. My body can switch back and forth between glucose and fat phenomenally fast. And I like fat better. I like burning fat better. When I go between meals and my blood glucose drops to 45 or 50, I feel amazing. I feel clear. I feel light. I don't get hungry. I don't feel driven by my need for food because it's like, I got plenty. I'm wearing it. I'm wearing it on my hips. I'm wearing it on my arms. I'm wearing it all over. So it's like, you're hungry? Go eat something. It's a steady stream because you've got it there. And it's when you can get somebody kicked into that, and you can help them to learn to be able to keto adapt quickly, then, and fasting, intermittent fasting helps people to do that. But again, some people just, they crash and burn with intermittent fasting. And so you have to work with that. Does that help?
It does. Thank you. I knew all of that from the blood sugar side, but it came in from the HPA axis, some stuff I was reading earlier today, and it got me a little confused. And it's like, okay, because so many people believe you have to eat so frequently. And I understand the biochemistry that you've been teaching us about spreading it out. But right. Then that threw me a curveball, and it's like, okay, well, how does that fit into the mix?
Yeah. So thank you. But whenever people have to eat frequently, and people who address it by telling them to eat frequently, it's a band-aid. It's yet another band-aid, right? They're not right. getting to the root cause. So I'm a big fan of band-aids while you're working on the root cause. And for some people, you do have to allow them to just eat more frequently, but with the idea that you're creating the balance underneath and you're gradually spreading it out. The human body was designed, I mean, come on, look back in history, right? We didn't have grocery stores on every corner. We didn't have a refrigerator to store the food. People had to go long periods of time without food. Right? And then they stored it on their body and then they were able to burn it and they could quickly shift between those two. And that's what we want. We want to be able to quickly shift between those two mechanisms. Make sense?
Right. It does. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And you're going to get a lot of flack when you talk to people about it, right? They're going to tell you crazy. And there's all kinds of personal trainers are telling people that. There's all kinds of people telling people that. And they'll argue with you. And when you write blog posts, they'll argue with your blog posts. We've had a lot of that happen, right, Lynn? Some of the articles that have had the most comments on them are the controversial ones, right? Like the spacing. You don't know. You have no idea. Yeah, I know. When I was in my 20s, I was like that too. And I bought into it, but I don't buy into it anymore, right? If you're having a problem, then you know that it's like, if I haven't had sleep, maybe I'm like, oh, ravenously hungry. I got to eat. It's because I didn't sleep. It's because one of the other areas was out of balance for me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you for that question. I love that gets me down that path I love to go down, which is like, really, I like to look at the science. That's why I teach the science, because you don't want to just believe hearsay and you don't want to just believe a study or somebody's opinion when you can look at the science and go, wait a minute, you want to lose weight, correct? Okay. So insulin prevents fat loss. Just does. I mean, it's a known fact. Look at the science. So does it make sense for you to have insulin elevated in your bloodstream all day long if you want to burn fat? No, it doesn't. It makes zero sense. So you want to get insulin low and at the baseline for a long time. You can also drive it back to meal spacing is so important for digestive health, right? How many people have SIBO? And how many people whose migrating motor complex is paralyzed? It's not working. Why? When you look at the science of the migrating motor complex, it doesn't start to kick in until 3.5 to 4 hours after you finished eating. So the system is empty and then it goes, okay, let's push this stuff along. Right? While you're eating, nothing happens. So if you want to restrict moving things in your digestive tract and burning fat to the hours between, 11 and 7 in the morning, when you're sleeping, or if you sleep less than that, even shorter hours, if you want to restrict those vital and very beneficial processes from happening only when you're sleeping, then you add to the mix, some people don't sleep soundly, so they don't even get into that mode. So it's like, how do we optimize the function? And going back to everybody's biochemically unique, and we have to adapt the principles, it's like we don't want to have it be dogma and religion. We have to adapt that then to what's the best thing for that person and how do we pick and choose. Yeah, good ones. Anybody else? Questions, comments? I saw Melody and Susan just joined us. This is our content and curriculum call. So we basically start out by focusing on, do you have questions about content, about the way to use the content within your practice? And then if we get all those questions answered, we can move on to cases and anything you want. I mean, I'm here to answer anything you want about patient client care. And thank you, Val, for that great question. Anybody else? It's going to be a short day.
Hi, Dr. Rita. This is Drina. I just want to, I'm kind of going back. You know, I've been through all of the foundational modules and now ready for some of the mastery stuff, but I'm going back to the Krebs cycle. It, you know, it seems so complex yet, I mean, simple, but complex. And so can you kind of refresh some about just how the fats are carrying so much with it, with relationship to digestion and insulin? And I mean, any like great pointers on the,
on fats? I'm not sure I understand your question. So well, how to get into the cells or how?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let's try this question a little bit differently because I'm not exactly sure, but it seems like a vague question. So
okay. Well, like it seems like with the Krebs cycle, we talk about the firefighters and is that the fats module?
I think that's the fats. Yeah. Okay. That's the fats. That's why I'm getting confused. Okay. Yeah. All the right. Firefighters are your fatty acid the cycle oxygenase, leukotrienes, the inflammatory cascade.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So that's where my question is.
Okay.
Is in the fats. And the whole idea of them going one way or the other, they go to either inflammation reduction or they go to arachidonic acid. And some of the things that cause that seem to be related to genetics, especially with like the one gal I have that I'm working with rheumatoid arthritis. It seems like there were a lot of factors in her fats that take her directly to arachidonic acid. Is there, you know, is there some like high point stuff with that?
You know, let's just look at it overview just to make sure everybody has that overview. So, I look at it like here's two sides. I always talk with my hands when I'm talking fats. Okay. So you've got omega-6, omega-3 and there's the long chain, the short chain, right? So alpha-linolenic, linolenic acid, right? And so we get them from the food we eat. Now, there's an enzyme that's shared between the conversion process between the two is delta-6 desaturase. Delta-6 desaturase then elongates those. So on the omega-3 side, it elongates them to EPA and DHA. Those are the main ones. And on the other side, it elongates them to to GLA and then DGLA and then arachidonic acid. There's no way to convert an omega-3 into arachidonic acid. It just doesn't happen. Okay. So when you have enough EPA or DHA, it actually squashes, it thwarts the action of arachidonic acid. So you may see an arrow going, but it's a negative arrow. It's like, oh, it decreases. So if you have enough EPA, DHA, it kind of dampens the effects of arachidonic acid. And then in order to make that conversion, you've got to have good B vitamins. Lots of B vitamins involved, lots of minerals involved, you know, vitamin C, magnesium and all that. And a lot of times folks just don't have that happening, right? They don't, but they also take the omega-6s in as arachidonic acid. That's coming from animal source foods and peanuts. It's the only one that's a significant source of arachidonic acid on the plant side. And so when people are eating a lot of those foods and they're either not getting enough omega-3, which is very common, how many of the average population eats a lot of, you know, raw walnuts, hemp seeds, chia seeds, flax seeds, right? They don't. So there's this deficiency. They're all eating this canola oil and the corn oil and the safflower oil and, you know, those things on the other side. And so they have this predominance of omega-6. Well, when you have a predominance of omega-6, you're making more of the fire. You're making more of the inflammatory chemicals, right? Mm-hmm. So it goes down and gets converted into those leukotrienes and cytokines and cyclooxygenases and all on the inflammatory side. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important that we look at people, not just from, you know, doing a test. A test is a great thing to do. And a lot of folks who have something like a rheumatoid arthritis or an autoimmune disease, they're going to have a much higher predominance of omega-6. In fact, when they look at them and you look at the AA-EPA ratio on those tests, when you look at MS and arthritis and, you know, all kinds of autoimmune diseases, that ratio is up in the 20-to-1 and sometimes higher range Whereas in somebody who's healthy, it's maybe in the 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 range. Mm-hmm. That's where we want to go to. Now, genetics always plays a part because there's specific pathways, and I don't know the exact genetics and the genes and the names of the SNPs and all that, that would affect that. But certainly genes might play a role in how well somebody is going to take that process through. But the truth of the matter is, the real culprit is the diet. Right. When we look at the diet, and even people who are on a healthy diet, right, they're on a raw foods diet, or they're on a vegan diet, they're on a macro diet, right? They're still eating way more omega-6 than 3. They're just way more omega-6 than 3. So it's really, that's a big piece of it. And I've taken people with RA and psoriatic arthritis and other kinds of arthritic conditions like that and cleaned up the diet, which is why I gave you that really cool spreadsheet that you can use with people, and you can say, okay, what did you eat? And you put in the different fats that they ate on that day, and you know what their ratio is. And then you can say, oh, look, if we just adjust this a little, let's just take out some of those almonds and put in some chia seeds or hemp seeds or walnuts in their place. Look at how that recipe shifts. That's going to be more of an anti-inflammatory food. So that's the way I'd love to see you working with people, is like really pulling apart their diet, using that spreadsheet to help them optimize what's coming in. Now, if you do that and the numbers still don't show right on the thing, or you, and you supplement, maybe you supplement, I like my algae omega kind of, you know, DHA, EPA, just for good measure, because maybe some days I don't, and maybe I don't sleep enough, and my B vitamins aren't working that well, and my delta 60 saturase isn't working that well. So then I have this insurance policy, and other people might take fish oil. So whichever one you take, which is preformed EPA, DHA. But the truth of the matter is, we don't need that. The essential fats are not DHA and EPA. Those aren't the essential fats. The essential fats that the body cannot make are the alpha-linolenic and the linoleic acid, right? So those are the essentials. The truth of the matter is, the standard lifestyle, years and years of abuse, we're not converting and making it. That's another piece. But given the body has the mechanism to make all but those two on the fat side, right? Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Yes.
Okay. How can I take this further for you?
Well, one of the things that I, you know, recognize with this gal is that she is really willing to do the flax and the hemp and everything, but she has so many digestive issues with IBS mm-hmm. that the other night when we talked about this with her, you had said to just grind everything into a liquid diet and have her go liquid. She was real receptive to that. Mm. So this is her second day, and you know, we're texting back and forth. I'm actually doing this with her so that she actually has a, someone that's, are you hungry? I'm starving. What do you, you know? And so it is helpful that, you know, I'm kind of walking through it with her, and she feels like that's a little extra support, but what I see is that she, even though she's incorporating a lot of the fats, and she does take a EFA supplement, she's so dry. And I just wonder if that's the IBS, that just not able to absorb the fats the way that she needs to. Is it a liver enzyme needed? Is it, I mean, I asked her, is she gassy and is she foul in her bowel movements? And she says really foul smelling. And I thought, well, that's pancreas. And so.
Well, that could, well, it could be things are undigested getting down there, and especially the proteins, like putrefactive byproducts of protein, you know, really stinky, really bad. So that could be that the pancreas isn't secreting it. It could be stomach acid. Mm-hmm. And it could be the organisms down there.
Okay. Right?
The disarray of organisms down there can be creating that. So that could be any one of those three factors, and you can address all of them.
Mm-hmm. I had her on digestive enzymes, but when she had that big bout of diarrhea, she was just like, oh, I'm stopping everything. And I said, well, I'm not sure the enzymes are the right thing to stop, but, you know, how about trying bitters? I mean, if you're not wanting to take a pill, let's try bitters and let's see. So she was able to get some bitters, and she is trying that. And so I haven't heard today. Today was her first day trying bitters. And even liquid, I feel like even liquid, because of all her bowel problems, that she still needs to take bitters. Is that conducive to what you would think.
Well, it depends on what she's having as liquid. If all she's having as liquid is water, no. Right? But if she's blending and making nut milks, or she's making creams and things like that with other, yeah, she does need it. And okay, it doesn't have to be a supplement, right? With somebody like that who's so sensitive, she could just take a little bit of arugula, you know, and juice it up or blend it up and then squeeze out the pulp and just swish it in her mouth for a few minutes and go like that. So it doesn't have to be a bitters formula, so to speak, because people like really find those foul and difficult. But, you know, or even just chewing it. If she's doing this all liquid, she could just chew it up and then spit out the pulp. She could be the human juicer.
Okay.
Just use that and just get the whole thing going, because that really does stimulate. Now, if somebody has, the times when I wouldn't use bitters right away would be when somebody has reflux, somebody has an ulcer, gastritis, because the bitters are going to stimulate the stomach acid. And right at that point, yes, they probably need more stomach acid, but they're not going to want more stomach acid because it doesn't feel so good. So that's where I would work with demulcents first and work with slippery elm and, you know, DGL and that sort of thing, marshmallow. Yeah. And help them to soothe and maybe do that for a couple of weeks and then start the bitters, but continue the slippery elm and whatever demulcents. So usually I'll have them do the bitters maybe, 10 or 15 minutes before the meal, followed shortly thereafter by the slippery elm, or vice versa, whichever way seems to give them the best comfort.
She was real willing to go with slippery elm to give it a try, because I'm like, well, you know, I really think you need something to kind of soothe your IBS. She doesn't have reflux. No backing up, no burning in the esophageal, you know, but she definitely is in the lower, you know, area, small intestine, large intestine.
Now, how do you differentiate small and large? Because typically I think of IBS as the large intestine.
Right. But what she gets is shortly after eating, she can like get bloating within 5 minutes.
Yeah. So she could have some SIBO going on.
Okay.
And SIBO is a leading cause of IBS. Mm-hmm. So it's organisms dysbiotic. Now, and other things you want to also always work with IBS in irritable bowel is working on relaxing the whole thing, right? To just like not have it be in spasm, because that's what's causing the problem. So chamomile and, what's the one that's, there's one that people use for progesterone, but can't think of the name of it, but that's usually really good for the gut. Wild yam can be really good soother for the gut, and any of the ones we listed as anti-spasmodic herbs could be very good for her.
Okay. Yeah, I did put her on chamomile tea. She seems to like that whole tea aspect, you know, rather than so much on the eating, but she loves to drink tea.
That's great. So, and peppermint, because if she doesn't have reflux, then peppermint is really, I mean, there's so many studies on peppermint, even a little bit of peppermint oil, can be super helpful for irritable bowel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Who else? Questions, comments? I don't see any hands up. Raise your hand. You can open up your line and raise your hand, or you can click on it on the side next to your name and raise your hand. I wonder if you could do it by your picture. I just discovered the other day that if you hover over your own picture, I think there's these three little dots, and it gives you all this stuff so you can raise hand, lower hand, whatever. I hadn't realized that before, so. Anything?
Not much. Dr. Marie. Hi, yeah. This is Eva.
Eva.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Sorry, I didn't get to hear your presentation. I'm going to go back and listen, but I just wanted to add to Drainas with the rheumatoid arthritis and the inflammation to check the vitamin D level, because that's a big anti-inflammatory, and many times the rheumatoid arthritis, they really low in vitamin D.
Yep.
So just check that. And I know that Dr. Tom O'Brien said that for vitamin D, the choice of vitamin D for people with gut issue would be the one that you actually swallow.
So, as opposed to the oil?
As the oil, yes. And then with vitamin K as the messenger.
For the vitamin. Especially it gets broken down later in the system and absorbed.
That's
an interesting point. Yeah. And vitamin D is important for anything related to digestion, depression, hormone imbalance. I mean, vitamin D is like, that's one of your foundations of place to look for just vitamin D.
Right.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Good.
Yeah, I'll just comment on that because her vitamin D is not low. I've had her supplementing in pill format. With 10,000 I use a day, she's actually at about 85. And so she's in a good range. I'd still actually like to see her a little bit higher with the fact that she has so much inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely helps with her moods. And she is, using a vitamin K also. So it's just, I mean, she's only really been on program for about 3 weeks, maybe a month. You know, we've been doing testing before we actually started a program, but 3 months ago I started her on a probiotic rotation. So three different kinds basically, rotating every 5 days. And so I was preparing her gut, but she really got, you know, kind of inflamed and kind of freaked out when the program kind of started. So there's a little too much raw food, I think, not enough cellulose breakdown. And so she's gone to steaming the foods and then blending them. And so I think I asked her if she could maybe try for 10 days. See what happens.
No,
you know, the longer the better.
Yeah, the longer the better. But you know, anything over 5 to 7 days is really soothing for the small intestine because of the turnover. And the other thing to consider with somebody who gets bloated right after eating is probiotic suppositories.
Oh, okay.
You know, you just get it, because then you don't have to worry about it. If you've got somebody who has SIBO, you want to be careful what kind of probiotics they take and do the D-lactic acid free or just the bifidus. But if you go up the bottom and you get them right where they need to be, and then you can also put cocoa butter or coconut oil would be the carrier, and that's real soothing. You know,
okay.
To get in there and calm things down. You could always put some kind of antispasmodic kind of an herb in there as well. I mean, there's so many things you could do with these cool suppositories, and you can get the molds on Amazon.
Okay. All right. Great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people get a little bit freaked out when you tell them to do that, but it's so effective. It's so, so effective.
I don't think she's going to be freaked out about anything. She's been through so much in her life that I'm not sure I could freak her out.
Good. That's always good. Great. All right. Who else? Questions, comments? Lynn, you have anything to add? Let's see. I don't see anything in the chat. Quiet today, hey? Are we all just all like mellowed out and caught up? And
so they... Did you?
Susan.
Oh, hi, Susan.
Hi, Lynn. We're completely snowed in.
Oh, wow, again. Ugh.
It's just never ending.
Wow. Lynn's in my kitchen. If you see right behind her, that's my kitchen window. She's downstairs, and it's about, I don't know, 70-ish right now. I like to see. So, yeah, I know it's tough here. It's really tough.
Can I ask you?
75.
Just.
He's 80 the other day, 82 the other day. So.
I have my neck warmer on, my hot water bottle.
But great. It's going to get cold tomorrow. No worries. We'll be joining you.
You'll get yours.
57 for a high tomorrow. So it's really, yeah.
So cold.
Yeah. You said you were putting a sweater on before.
I did put my sweater on, but it was because I hadn't moved yet. So
anyway, what can I help you with today, Susan?
Well, I just hopped onto the call and I want to make sure that I'm, you know, within the subject matter. So is there a specific subject matter that you guys are talking about?
Well, subject matter wise, this is a content and curriculum. So any content and curriculum questions at all you have. And then once we finish those questions where we can do case, you know, not a full case, like don't give me labs and stuff like that, but just ask questions about people. So.
Okay. I had a question about a person.
Okay.
So I'm working with a woman who's 65. She's hypothyroid. She has Hashi's. She has RA, Trojans, you know. And her TSH is super suppressed.
So she's on meds, I'm assuming then.
Yeah, she's on synthetic T4 and T3, a combination.
Okay.
She's in Rome, so it's kind of difficult to get a handle on a lot of things, but basically her TSH is suppressed, but her T4 is normal and her T3 is low. And
her T4 is normal.
Yeah.
And her T3 free or both?
Free T3
is low.
Is low. And running her numbers through the blood chem software, of course, a selenium deficiency is something that popped up.
Right.
But on top of that, what showed up in the blood chem software was some potential hypopituitary issues.
I think that when they're on medication, that doesn't count. Yeah, she's on hypopituitary because the medication is suppressing her pituitary from stimulating her thyroid.
Right.
So if she has a very low TSH, it means that whatever amounts she's taking in is saying, nope, we're good. We got it, which is going to suppress her ability to make. When she's on both T4 and T3 and her T3 is low, that's even uber more important to look at a conversion issue because she's actually taking some. You know, on the one hand, you can look at having those levels upped. Doctor may not want to do that because that might further suppress the pituitary, lowering the T4 a little bit in the dose and upping the T3. But again, you know, most docs don't want to mess with that and muck with that. But that would be what I would be looking at is that balance. But then we want to look at, okay, how do we get her stimulated? Like, what's her stress level like? If her stress level's high, then that's also going to interfere. Selenium, yes. Iodine, it could be magnesium, zinc. All of those things could be related to why she's not converting.
Yeah.
And then
so I just had her order a whole bunch of those tests. So hopefully she'll get a draw on Friday. All of those are in there. But I'm suspecting an insulin resistance issue. Type 2 diabetes runs in her family.
Yep.
And some adrenal dysfunction. She's under a lot of stress. Then. So a lot of it is just, you know, getting her to understand that it's more than just going to the doctor and listening to what the doctor's saying, which is what she'd prefer to do because it's easier.
It's easier, yeah. 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 Make sure you get her homocysteine done because here's the thing that most people overlook with thyroid. You go and you go, oh yeah, this looks like a conversion issue or this looks like a low output production issue and let's address it. And then you get it addressed and they still feel like crap, even though their numbers look perfectly. What is that? What do you think? What is it we missed? Who knows this?
Well, I would say her adrenals.
There's something very specific that her adrenals would impact related to thyroid. What do we think when the thyroid numbers all look good, but they still show thyroid symptoms?
Cortisol.
Cortisol could cause what? Okay. I'm going to just drum this one into you guys because you're the hero when you catch it because so many people are missing it. Lynn? What am I relating to? What am I talking about? All the thyroid numbers look normal, but they still have thyroid symptoms. What are we thinking? Mary? Mary's gone. Mary, you should know this.
Okay, it's not zinc, it's not selenium, it's not magnesium.
It's a condition of describing, a condition that we're going to describe.
Yes. The rest. So you said all the thyroid numbers
look normal, but they still have thyroid symptoms. What are you thinking?
Well, so like with Wilson's temperature syndrome where their body is
that too. What else? What is that effect? What are we talking about? What are we dealing with in sweet spot right now? What condition?
Well, that's what I was wondering if it has to,
resistance, right?
Right.
Insulin resistance, thyroid resistance. The cells, the receptors they can't get it. They're going, well, everything looks good, but they're not picking up. That's why I said get homocysteine.
Yeah.
Homocysteine impacts the receptors. Vitamin A impacts the receptors. So in folks who have a SNP, that BCMO1, where they don't convert beta carotene to vitamin A real well, those people are more at risk for thyroid resistance. And you said it, cortisol, high levels of cortisol inflammation of any kind. So a person with RA or any kind of autoimmune disease is going to have a lot of cytokines, and the cytokines affect that. So okay. We can have a perfectly normal, and these people are being turned away in droves and given Prozac.
Yeah.
Right? Because they have all these symptoms of thyroid issue, but their lab tests are normal. So here's your prescription. It must be all in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And those poor people are not being told how to fix those receptors. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm on her now about her insulin receptors, but it's going to take time to get her head wrapped around the work it's going to take.
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge with
it. And that's going to affect it too, right? Because insulin, high levels of glucose and insulin will affect, insulin in particular, will affect the T4 to T3 conversion.
Yeah. Right.
Well, I know you repeatedly tell us to always assume there's thyroid.
Always assume resistance.
Yeah.
No matter what they show as, always assume there's also resistance and work that and check, rule out, is it high homocysteine? Is the vitamin A low? Do they have inflammation somewhere, right? How are the adrenals doing? Because if you don't address those things, then you're going to get everything. Oh, the conversion's working perfectly. Look, everything works great. And they still feel like crap.
Right.
So I always assume resistance.
You
one thing. Sorry, Lynn, go ahead.
I was just going to say that if you haven't gone through the Thyroid Revive and Thrive program for that stuff, I mean, all the 22 patterns of dysregulation and,
right,
that is just an incredible resource.
Yeah. And our thyroid module here is going to be coming out real soon. In fact, Lynn and I are going to work on it this weekend.
That's why I'm here.
Get it all finished, that and a couple of others that come right after it.
Well, I'll tell you something that I just thought of. Her DHEA was like at the bottom, like super low tanked. But her doctor has been supplementing her with 125 milligrams a day of DHEA.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the thing, right? DHEA, that high level of DHEA is going to suppress her adrenal output. So it's like, okay, got it made, don't need to make any. So high levels of DHEA like that in a female, I think should be banned and outlawed and illegal and malpractice. And that's my opinion, but I just think it shouldn't be allowed unless somebody actually is like, they're in Addison's disease, they're not making anything at all and they can't make it, then you have to give them. But that's a lot of DHEA. Secondly, DHEA is not a base bottom of the line.
Right.
Right? It can be converted. So what can it be converted to? Testosterone, right? What can testosterone be converted to? DHT, dihydrotestosterone. And
there are
some some of them genetically controlled mechanisms where somebody is going to have a high level of the enzyme, the beta. I'm drawing a blank. I'm seeing the picture there. But anyway, it's a reductase. The 5-alpha reductase, 5-beta reductase. So you have to have that balance. And otherwise you go to DHT, which is it's a carcinogenic form. It's a very powerful, causes male pattern baldness. Well, you see a woman who's starting to lose their hair. I'm going to start thinking DHT.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And when you give the person too much DHEA and it can get converted to testosterone, right? And it gets downstream converted. Some people have too much of the aromatase. Most men, as they age, they have aromatase deficiency, which means that their testosterone gets converted to estrogen.
Right.
But some people may have the opposite, where their estrogen levels are low in their progesterones, but their testosterone's high. But it also can be converted downstream to estrogen. What could that happen? Well, if they're not eating enough cruciferous vegetables, they don't have the right zinc levels, they don't have all that stuff in order, those estrogens, they get converted down, they go to 4-hydroxyestrogen. We'll go through way more of this in that module, but 4-hydroxy is a very dangerous carcinogenic form, right? So there's so many, it's like, that's why it's so important to understand all these pathways, because okay, well, what does it mean? They're given DHEA, but there's no DHEA in the system, right? Okay, what can be happening? It's going somewhere, right? It doesn't just disappear if it's done in the right way. Sometimes if she has irritable bowel, she's pooping it out and she's not getting it in, or if it's in a tablet, which the typical pharmaceuticals are, with shellac and talc and all kinds of other crap in them, they don't actually get absorbed. So it could be that. Check the toilet to see if her tablets are coming out. But typically, like if I give a sublingual, and you know it's going right in, right? But the blood doesn't show it. That says to me that she's using it to go downstream to other metabolites. And it's good to understand that pathway. Like I actually see that chart in my brain. And you haven't looked at it enough to see it, but it's, I show it in the adrenals. I show how, you know, the cortisol, the pregnenolone to progesterone down to DHEA and, you know, the whole thing. I can see that in my brain. And go, oh, okay. And that's a good thing to have when somebody, I'm high in this and low in that. Going back to the Krebs cycle question before, right? If somebody, you're looking at them and you're doing amino acids, you're looking at B vitamins and like, wow, they're high in this, but low in this. Ah, what's the pathway? What's converting it, right? That's why I love oat tests, right? What's the pathway? It's high here, low here. Whoops. You know, it says a lot about niacin or riboflavin or something that's going to help it convert.
Right.
And the more you get exposed to this and the more you study it and the more cases you do and the more you look things up, if you have a case that you're not sure about and ask questions, the more it's just going to be imprinted in your brain.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's real detective work.
It is detective work, right?
And then you're dealing with the whole psychological component with the person, right? There's denial there. There's, it's denial, right?
Yeah. And the mindset piece is so important for them to need to get a handle on and for us to help them guide. So we can't just know biochemistry. We have to be able to understand how to coach people and how to motivate and inspire them, but also how to explain things. Take what I'm teaching you in this geeky way. How do you explain it down in the, like, the firefighters and the, you know, you just explain it to them in a way that they get and they start to visualize their, it's called personification, right? You take inanimate objects and you give them life. And when you can take the organs of the body and you give them life and they start to see this one shoveling this one and this one, they start to go, oh, I better not do that because, you know, it's going to cause my liver to kick the ass of my, you know, whatever.
Right.
So, you know, if you can, the more you can explain that to them. And that's why I really feel it's important for people to understand what's going on rather than just here, take this pill. Oh yeah, you have this adrenal problem. Here's some supplements. You know, let me know how you do. Dare and meditate. And then, but why? Why are they doing it? Right? Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's a fine art.
Yeah. Yeah.
Diplomacy is involved.
It's the biggest job in the world.
But we've, you know, we've taken it on and it's great because it's needed, right? Because so many folks are just, poor things, they're just not getting the right advice and they're just putting on medications that don't work. And even somebody who thinks they know something about functional medicine or nutrition, they're just handing out supplements.
Yeah.
I was listening, I had to do a relicensure course yesterday and it's a 12-hour online thing and on the digestive tract. Like I teach the digestive tract. Couldn't I just submit my module, you know, my 25 hours of digestive stuff and say, can I just get credit for what I created? Do I have to listen to somebody else's? No, I had to listen and answer the questions on the test. And somebody said, well, you know, they're showing it. I said, look, she's got a hemoglobin A1C of 5.7. And his comment, and this is somebody who's, you know, this is the integrative, whatever, functional, whatever. He's teaching, he's an MD teaching other MDs about functional medicine. And he goes, oh, that's perfectly normal. Yeah, it says it's abnormal, but that's just, they just do that because they want to sell more metformin.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, huh, do you get that hemoglobin A1C of 5.7 means that the average blood glucose is in the 120s? That's diabetic, right? If the average is in the 120s, it's going way higher.
Yeah.
At some point, and maybe it goes down to 110 sometimes. But, and he wasn't getting that. Oh, you know, let's just ignore that. Like, I'm like, this is the kind of education that even the medical people that are looking for more. Now, give him credit. He had a lot of good stuff in there. But it was like, oh, yeah, they have parasites. Let's just put him on Flagyl for a while.
Oh, my God.
We're supposed to be teaching functional medicine here.
Right.
But he kept saying we want to get to the root cause, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a lot of disconnects there because of the medical mentality for so long. And, you know, people aren't used to us actually, people who think like, oh, if this happens, then I wonder why. Let's look at the science of why and let's understand it so we can get in there. And hope that helps and not just.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Yeah.
Good. Every time I talk to you, it helps.
I try to be helpful.
And then I get drilled.
Okay, resistance. What's the most thyroid resistance? We always have to look for thyroid resistance and manage that as the same time we're doing whatever other, you know, you were right on, you know, conversion issue. Okay, yeah, conversion issue. But always look for, and of course, the antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
You got to look for the antibodies.
She's got elevated antibodies.
Yeah, and you've got to look at, like, that whole thing. And if you just go to the fifth module in Thyroid Revive and Thrive, there's a video and just a document, 30-page document. I should be able to sell that document for hundreds of dollars because it's so succinct and so thorough.
Uh-huh.
And it's on the different, like, I break it down from, like, 22 dysfunctions down to the seven main dysfunctions. And within each of those, there's more. And we don't go there. But it's basically broken down in layperson's language, sort of sophisticated laypeople's language, I guess. But it's very, I print it out and put it, I like to keep a little, you know, a notepad like this. It's not going to come out. Okay. So you take a binder, right? And you just start to put tabs in it. And you just have all the little cheat sheets.
Okay.
That make sense. So you have that, you know, blood glucose conversion SI to standard international to US, because if you're working with people in another country, or you want to just look it up when they say, oh, my blood sugar was 5.7, you're like, what does that mean, right? You look it up. Nice chart to have in there, right? The thyroid booklet, there's another one in the adrenal program, and this is on the client side, and they're just really useful reference charts.
Okay.
Right? Really useful reference charts, and just have all your cute little nice stuff in one place so you can be looking it up real quick. You don't have to memorize all that. I can't memorize all that stuff.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. I appreciate that.
Yeah. You're welcome. You're welcome. Who else? Questions, comments, discussions? No? Well, we actually made it to 53 minutes.
Actually, I'm going to press this on a little longer. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's it.
I have a gal that I'm working with now. She's 85 years old. And I talked to you about her before. She has this overabundance of saliva.
Mm.
But for 85, I'm amazed at this woman. She has gone gluten-free, gone dairy-free, gone sugar-free. I mean, she has made some amazing changes. But there is something that is still... I can't put my finger on it. And so she has high blood pressure in the morning. Now, I attain this to having also high cortisol probably in the morning. And I don't know if that's, you know, where your mind would go, but it gets lower during the day, as of course her cortisol would also. But she gets a little spike before bed and doesn't sleep very well. Although, changing the diet in this last week, she started to see some remarkable changes, but her blood pressure is still high in the morning, like 158, 160, or 90.
Okay. Okay.
She is a tall
first thing in the morning, and then it goes down as the day goes on.
Yeah. She is a tall woman, so I don't expect her to have, like, you know, 120 over 70, you know, so she's like 5'9". And not overweight, 135.
What's her fasting blood sugar?
Was 87.
And what makes you think cortisol? Have you tested her cortisol, or are you just guessing cortisol?
It's a thought process that I'm having, and mostly because I know her stress levels with having a husband with Alzheimer's, and you know, she just struggles to relax. And she was having even more trouble when she was feeding herself sugar, you know. So things are improving now that she's eliminating, you know, a lot of foods. And for a woman at 85 to even begin that, you know, process, I'm impressed. But I'm still curious if it could be possible that the blood pressure meds that she's on could be causing.
Okay, she's on blood pressure meds. What time of day does she take her meds?
In the morning. She takes them after she takes her blood pressure.
All right. So, and then she just takes it once a day.
Yeah, 5 milligrams.
So it wears off.
Yes.
Okay. So we want to look at what other things can she be doing to get the blood pressure down. So clearly meditative things, tapping, you know, heart map, all those kinds of things to get her to do that on a regular basis. Does she exercise at all?
She does, and she does meditate. She does an hour meditation every morning.
Wow.
I know. That's impressive, isn't it? And then she swims at least 4 days a week. She swims laps, and she walks. We've got a rec center here that has a walking pool. And so she walks, you know, and does that 4 days a week.
Right. And then does she test her blood pressure right before she goes to bed? Is it starting to inch up?
No, her blood pressure is the lowest at nighttime.
And so
even with a little spike of cortisol, which in this last week has stopped happening for her, so she's not getting that racing heart at nighttime now. So that I'm sure was related to some of the foods that she was eating, especially at dinner time, because some of it was like sweet potatoes and things like that, which she wasn't really able to handle, I don't think, with her blood sugar. But she's still dealing.
So it's low at bedtime and then it raises during the night. So a couple of things I would look up. One is I would look up the medication. Is she on one medication, two?
One.
One medication. I would look up the medication and look to see how long the average span of how long it works for.
Okay.
I would look to see what the mechanism is, because the reason it goes down during the day is because she takes her blood pressure medication, right? Mm-hmm. If ever she didn't, I don't want to tell people not to take their medication for the day, but if she didn't and she measured it, it'd probably be a very different picture, right? There are a number of things that she could be doing to facilitate that. She may have calcium-magnesium imbalance. Magnesium is super important for blood sugar, blood pressure. So I don't know if she's eating enough of that or if you've replenished. If she's 85 and she's just, you know, changing her diet now, that's a lot of decades of imbalance, right? Right?
Yeah.
So there are things that can be done to help with managing blood pressure temporarily. Magnesium is one of my favorites, is to really get her, make sure she has plenty of magnesium. Just get her on a magnesium supplement and have her take that. Watch that the blood pressure doesn't go down too low. Natokinase. She could actually eat natto if she wanted to, but the enzyme that's in natto, which is a fermented soybean, is basically very good at being an anticoagulant and antispasmodic, and it brings things down.
Okay.
But magnesium and that, and then what else? I mean, certainly all the nutrients that we know about, the stress management nutrients, seeing about the cortisol, if you think it's the cortisol. But it doesn't sound that way, because if she was having a spike in the cortisol at night, but the blood pressure wasn't going up, it doesn't necessarily mean that. But if she's having a bad night's sleep and not sleeping well and she's up and down and
that's what she does.
Then that could raise it. She's worried. She's, you know, and people get more and more stressed the less they sleep, right? Mm-hmm. By three, you're like really worried and then you're really frustrated. And it's just, instead of it being restful, it's not restful. So might help her with some magnesium and work on her sleep.
Like, okay.
What you can do to help her to sleep better.
Well, she is starting to sleep better now. She's only up once in the night rather than five times in the night, because the saliva is, you know, starting to come down. I do have her on Seeking Health Bone Builder, because she does have knee problems, hip problems, blah, 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 which of course is calcium deficiency and magnesium. And so she is making some slow changes. She will not do like these, you know, like a massive change, but I've started to integrate like EFAs, things like that. But her blood pressure was not lower at nighttime before I started her on a diet regimen and the EFAs.
Okay.
It was
so high. You're seeing improvement already.
Exactly. So it's like even though she's taking the meds, I'm kind of beginning to wonder if maybe she doesn't really require so much meds, and she would be one of those that would be willing to try a day or two without them.
I wouldn't suggest it. If she comes up with the idea, you just say, that's a good idea. Check with your doctor.
Yeah.
Right? Check with your doctor to see if he's okay with you doing a 2-day trial of no meds, just to see what the natural rhythm is. But clearly, if it used to be high at night and now it's not anymore, has it come down? Is it lower than it was before in the morning? Just not quite normal?
Okay, let me see if I understood your question.
So if it's now 150 something over 90, what was it higher than that before you started working with her?
Yes.
Okay.
It was like 165.
Good. You're moving in the right direction. Right? So I would continue to do the things that you're doing and continue to get her to come bring it back down more and have her watch for hypotension. Sometimes, here's the thing, when you put something in somebody's head, we're going to be doing stuff and it's going to lower your blood pressure. It's going to lower your blood pressure. It has a very high probability of going to lower your blood pressure. So I want you to be aware. Here's some of the signs that your blood pressure is going too low. Now you've put it in their psyche like, oh, my blood pressure is going down. Right? Mm-hmm. And the mindset can actually have huge effects on the body.
Yes.
Right? And so I would keep doing that. There are plenty of things that you can do to help her specifically with getting the blood pressure down. But at this point, it might be even too soon to try because they are strong if she's 85. If she was 45, I would say, yeah, no worries. Like African snake root, amazing for blood pressure. Restorative Formulas has a really, really powerful HTN formula, I think is what it's called. Hypertension, but they can't say that. So HTN, whatever. But it's got that in it. It's very good. Nattokinase again, but you just have to be careful, when you're working with somebody older like that.
Yeah. I think her doctor, she had asked him, if the blood pressure meds, if it was time to change them. And he said, no, I think you're doing fine where you're at. Although her blood pressure was still high, even taking the meds. So now I think that it's starting to show coming down. I mean, she was pretty impressed. She's down, you know, sometimes 20, 25 points.
That's great.
So, you know, I think that's pretty impressive.
How long have you been working with her?
3 weeks.
You're on the right track, girl. You're definitely on the right track. And just, you can start to look for more as you go through. But, you know, the whole thing about looking for the horse, I think horses, not zebras, right? I think you're on the right track, and I don't know that there's going to be any, you know, major thing, but if it's not, you know, you give it a little bit longer, then you can start to look at a specific thing you may want to have a printout of it that you give her and say, take this to your doctor and see if there's any contraindications to taking this with your meds. I wouldn't mess with it in somebody in that age range unless you are really careful.
Yeah, he's pretty willing. She had told him what she was going to start on. And he said, well, there's no problem with what, you know, you're taking to start on that. He said, I want to hear from you in a couple months and let's see if this girl even can help you at all. And I started laughing. I said, well, okay, well, that it will be interesting just to kind of give him some feedback. And I'm more than willing to go in with her to him because I know him personally. Great. So that wouldn't be a problem. So, okay.
Awesome.
Continue on the track.
Yeah, I think you're on the right track. You know, whenever we start to see shifts, you've got to think about how long has she been on medication for her blood pressure? Probably years.
Years, yeah.
Decades even at that age, right?
Yeah, years. But I think that he will be one of those willing ones to start cutting, you know, let's cut the pill in half and see how you do and, you know, kind of work down really slowly. And she'll be willing to do that when she can, you know, kind of hear from him that things are better.
Right. I know I worked with my sister at one point and got her off her blood pressure medication, or she got herself off her blood pressure medication, we'll say. But what we did was we went to every day and a half. So she'd take it in the morning one day and then she'd wait until not the next morning, but that evening, the next day,
okay.
The next 2 days later in the morning. And that worked really well. And then she went to every 2 days and she eventually just got off of it completely.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're good. I see Elaine just opened up her. Hi, Elaine.
Yeah, I'm wondering how would that same scenario vary with a person that has a pacemaker?
Careful, 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 right? So you just really, you don't want to get in the middle of some therapeutic regime that could be strong, like certainly giving people nutrients, pretty safe, right? And then, but anytime you're going to get into any like herbs and things like that, I would be really, really careful to work with their doctor, because you don't want somebody to say, hey, you know, she was fine and now she had a stroke because of what you did, right? And it may not even be the person, because maybe the person dies from whatever reasons unrelated to you, but the family is like, my quacky mother, you know, she went to see this quacky nutritionist person and let's sue her, you know?
Yeah. I'm just wondering, she has a lot of health issues and she has had health issues for 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
You know how long she's been on.
Yeah, well, foundations usually clears it, you know, a lot of the foundational stuff. And you only go to that other stuff, especially in the older population, when you're either working with the doctor and you're really clear or the foundations aren't working, right? Because so many times it helps. Like, look what you've done in 3 weeks. That's amazing.
Just changing food, though.
Changing food, that's
harmless, basically.
It's food, right? You know, be careful if somebody's, the only time to be careful with food changes is when somebody's on blood thinners like Coumadin. Coumadin has a lot of contraindications because all the foods make it unnecessary and it accentuates the process that it works on. So it's like, well, why don't we just give them more EFAs and less Coumadin? But no, you got to be careful. Right. So yeah, that's the one time that I really am cautious about just having people do basic dietary changes, because a lot of the greens, and their doctor said, no, you can't eat greens because you're on Coumadin.
Okay. Yeah. She's not on Coumadin.
Great.
That was the one I worried about.
Yeah. I always say to people, look, I'm just going to give you some health education about your diet and make sure that it's okay with your doctor if you're on medication.
How much does something like cinnamon impact a person's diet in relation to that area?
Massively lower their blood sugar, increase their insulin sensitivity. So if you have somebody who's been prone to, like somebody's on insulin, right? And it starts to drop it down, it could be that they're over-medicated on their insulin. And that could be a problem, right? Because it actually has the insulin be effective now because it's getting into the cells. So cinnamon, you know, high levels of it, but the food kind, like sprinkle it on my food, like hard to get into trouble. It's when you're doing teaspoonfuls at a time, and most people don't do teaspoonfuls of a time of cinnamon unless they're doing it therapeutically.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question. Anyone else? Did you have anything to add, Lynn?
Yeah. Well, actually I was going to say Melody had a good question in the chat. Seeing a lot of people who have high triglycerides and low HDL, low alkaline phosphatase, and so she was thinking zinc deficiency.
Mm-hmm. Zinc deficiency and insulin resistance.
They could also be
the EFAs.
Right. Well, so your magnesium,
mm-hmm.
Vitamin D, B12.
Well, all the things that we talk about with insulin sensitivity, insulin resistance. So when I see high triglycerides, low HDL, I'm thinking insulin. B1 is a really critical one there. So your B vitamins, your zinc, your magnesium, chromium, all of those things, right? Those are the things I'm thinking insulin resistance. And then with the low alk-phos, I'm thinking like B6 and zinc are the main ones.
The other thing that I've been noticing lately too, because I've started seeing something similar to that, but it's not just the zinc, but it's the zinc copper ratio.
Oh yeah.
You know, a lot of people are, that ratio is suddenly becoming really, imbalanced. And I'm thinking that it's the toxins in our air around us, especially if you live in an area that has a high, like air traffic, or mm-hmm. other other places like that. So
yeah, hit that and, you know, copper pipes. And, interestingly enough, the same course I was saying before, somebody was saying, well, he had a high, very high copper on his heavy metal thing. You said, well, he collects rainwater and he has a copper roof.
Oh,
right. And so, but they said, well, I don't know that that's going to have an effect. Yeah. And then it was like, well, he showers, he takes hot baths and showers with this.
Well, and then the other is, how is he testing it? Because it's going to look different in a blood serum than it is in something like,
hair or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, but that's an important piece. And so people are zinc deficient. A lot of people are very zinc deficient. So, you know, getting the high zinc foods and supplementing. There's the rat studies that showed that no matter how much zinc you took during your lifetime, if your mom was zinc deficient when she was carrying you, that you're going to be needing to supplement your whole life through. So if mom was smoking cigarettes and eating crap and was zinc deficient, right? And zinc is so critical for like so many different enzymes, you know, your stomach acid, your digestive enzymes, your sex hormones, your all your hormones, your receptors, right? Yeah. Hormone receptors, yeah. Yeah. Good questions.
Yeah, I'm just trying to see here.
And copper, high copper zinc ratios can create anxiety and those sleep issues where people can't fall asleep, they're tossing and turning, they're anxious. That's very common. There's a condition called pyloria, where there's a buildup of cryptopyrroles. Cryptopyrroles build up because you don't have enough B6 and zinc, and copper affects that. Copper can impact serotonin levels. The conversion from tryptophan to serotonin. So, you know, when we're starting to look at people who are depressed or anxious or having sleep issues, those trace minerals are super, super important. And in that module, the micronutrients module, I don't know how many of you have been through it before, but it was like 25 hours worth of stuff because there's just so much in these interactions. One of the things we thought about giving you guys as a project to do is to create a chart of all of the nutrients and then what all they interfere with would be really cool to do.
So she says, so you wouldn't get enough in stable ionic trace. I think she must mean ionic trace mineral formula.
I would say add a zinc, an ionic zinc if you suspect that.
It's not that you wouldn't get enough, it's just that it's always going to need to be done, right? Is that what you're saying in terms of if your mother...
Yeah, you're always going to need to supplement. Oh, yeah, it might be. Oh, if you're talking about somebody who does, yeah, it might be plenty. As you know, 20 milligrams of zinc a day, 20, 30, unless you're showing overt signs and symptoms, you should be okay. And this was these rat studies where there were no overt signs or symptoms happening, that when they gave them the zinc throughout their life, they were fine. They had no signs blood test wise or other. But then once they, those rats had babies, their babies were born zinc deficient and they had to be supplemented again. So, you know, how much does it apply to humans? I think it probably does. It may not just be, it may be the number of generations that's related to, right? It may not go four generations like in rats. Maybe it only goes two in humans. I don't know. But it's just really worth looking at.
So when you were talking here about sleep, sometimes if you have a sleep debt, people will take a short 10, 20-minute nap. I know if I do that, I have a hard time with it because I'll wake up groggy.
Yeah, me too. But some people do great with it. Some people, those power naps, you do great with it. Yeah.
So what would be the reason that you and I don't do well with it, but somebody else would?
Who knows?
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, okay. It could be that you and I don't get sufficient sleep. I don't know.
What's that, Elaine?
I know I used to do fine with it. When I was homeschooling and running crazy with kids and not sleeping with all my Hashimoto stuff, if I set my alarm, as long as I knew my alarm was going to go off and I set 15 minutes, I could hit that bed and I was gone.
You know, it probably has to do with your sleep cycles, right? It probably has to do with the fact that you can get in quick and then back out, whereas mm-hmm. you and I maybe just go and have a longer phase one, and then, you know, you never get into the restorative sleep.
So, were you bad before, though, when you were unhealthy? Because that I did that well when I was unhealthy and mm-hmm. was deprived and high stress, and I don't take naps anymore, so I don't know how I did it.
Yeah, I've tried it. Like if I've stayed up all night on a flight and I'll go, oh, I'll just take a short cat nap and then I'll go to bed later. No, I'm better off just staying up the whole time. And that probably has to do with the duration of the various phases of the sleep cycle. Yeah. And
I think too that there's that underlying, at least for me, not really allowing myself to really sleep, you know, cause I homeschooled too. And it was just always that need to be on. And so, you know, the fact that you could let yourself go and sleep, it says a lot about you.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it could be good. TBD values. What does that mean?
Say what?
You wrote TBG values, question mark.
Oh, we were talking about
binding globulin?
Yeah.
You have to look them up.
No, we were talking about the different things to consider with the different, thyroid issues when you were talking with Susan.
Okay, that TB, thyroid binding globulin. And you know what affects thyroid binding globulin levels is estrogen levels. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So excess estrogen will cause an increase in thyroid binding globulin, which is less of the free hormone available. And Melody asked about how do you get that access to the thyroid program? So you basically log into your site, and over on the right-hand side, it'll say Vibrant Living Members Site. And you click that and you go over there and you look for thyroid. And I don't know if she has it listed so you see each of those.
You can. There is a drop down.
There's a drop down. So yeah, so it'll have the little down arrow and you look for thyroid and then you go there.
Right. And I put the link to it in the chat.
Yeah. And it's not available if you're in, it's only available if you're in Mastery, because Mastery includes thyroid and adrenals, whereas Foundations doesn't. So you just get the client programs for the ones that are included in either Foundations or Mastery.
Yeah.
And what happens if you get their homocysteine low? Well, high homocysteine disrupts the ability of those thyroid receptors to receive the thyroid hormone. And it's an inflammatory chemical, so it inflames them enough that they don't accept it. So then you want to work on bringing down their homocysteine levels. Most of the time it's because of deficiencies of B6, B12, and or folate, so some combination of that, those three. And that responds really quickly. When you give people that, their homocysteine comes down. It's one of the few things that Western medicine is actually doing regularly. When they see high homocysteine, they give them a B vitamin supplement, and it works. With the SNP, which keeps homocysteine low, what other markers would you check to see if they thyroid? Well, the thyroid, homocysteine is not a marker for thyroid resistance. It's an aggravant. It's something that causes it. So if you have a SNP that keeps the homocysteine low, then that's not going to be aggravating the receptor. So the other things that aggravate the receptors would be low vitamin A. They need vitamin A in order to work properly. Cytokines, so some kind of inflammatory process, high or low cortisol, so too high or too low cortisol, so the just right Goldilocks amount of cortisol is needed. I think that's all I can think of off the top of my head. There may be one or two others. Oh, and high levels of reverse T3. So if reverse T3 is high, and that often happens when we have a bad conversion from T4 to T3, a lot of it, instead of going to T3, goes to reverse T3. And then that reverse T3 blocks the receptors so that the free T3 can't get in. So that's another one. Okay. Anybody else? Did I miss anything?
Nope.
Okay. Well, thank you, everybody. Great call. Lots of great information shared. I hope it was helpful. Was it helpful for everybody? Let me know. I'll unmute you guys.
Yes.
Helpful? Yes.
Very helpful.
Good.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
You're going to record it, right?
Bye.
It's all recorded. It's yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. All right. I come in late. I had an appointment, so I want to make sure I get it all.
Oh, absolutely. It's recording. I'm going to stop the recording now, and it'll get posted as soon as it renders. It has to do this little render thing, and then I upload it to the website.
Oh. One of our Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Thank you. Welcome.